Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest edition of Life on Planet Porky. And I want to say, Leslie Ann, of course, in the chair with me here in a self-isolating studio, as am I, some of the responses we've been getting lately for these podcasts have been very, very heartening indeed, and wider ranging with every broadcast.
And happy to be entertaining the nation.
Yes, very happy to be entertaining the nation as well. Now, we've got lots to talk about in this podcast, but there's one particular issue that I want to bring to the attention of our hopefully millions of listeners, because I thought that what you did over the last weekend that transpired between our last podcast and this one, to salute your children after their years of hard work and their graduations in their respective studies was absolutely quite marvellous. Graduation day at home. I mean, we've seen all sorts of things have happened during lockdown. We've seen Colonel Tom, who's walked in his garden. We've seen little children who've been hobbling around, you know, and trying so very hard to raise money for the health service. We've seen all sorts of things. We've seen people who have had to, you know, improvise getting their hair cut and all that. But tell us, please, about your improvisation for the graduation ceremony for your kids that, of course, they never got.
Oh, my younger two, Henry and Bridie. Henry was a student for 4 years at Arts Ed in Chiswick. Bridie was a student of English at Exeter University for 3 years. They happened to graduate the same year, not that they're the same age, but my son had deferred a year because he broke his knee in a rugby accident. Ooh. And so he had to, as a ballet dancer, you know, ballet, acting, singing, he's musical theatre. So he couldn't dance anymore, had to defer and come back.
Golly.
So they're both due to graduate this year, but of course the universities are closed down because of the pandemic.
Yep.
And they were very miserable that all these years of work they had led up to no graduation. So I said, right, come on, we're going to do it at home. So I sourced the gowns and the mortarboards online. I
really?
Ordered
it. Had those sent to your house, the black gown and the old...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like... Managed to find a source of those, bought those, ordered a cake. Class of 2020, congratulations, Henry and Bridie. We had my mother, who I had to go to Kent and get,
right.
And we made a sumptuous spread. I ordered some engraved presents for them, a hip flask for my son,
wow.
And a bangle that's engraved with the dates and everything for my daughter.
Yeah.
And then I wrote a speech. We had the music stand as a lectern in the garden.
Yeah.
And I gave my speech. They then in turn got up and made speeches. Everybody cried.
Wow.
Yeah, we had a land of hope and glory as they walked out into the garden in their gowns and hats. And then we had a photo session. So they now have their pictures to frame to prove that they've graduated.
Fantastic.
And my son said at the end, he's very cool, you know, he never is impressed by anything. But he said, Mommy, that was better than the real thing.
That's excellent. And I suppose the one sadness was that your father wasn't there to see it all. A man of letters himself. And of course, sadly, passed away very recently. But what a wonderful tribute to your family. And these pictures, Leslie Ann, I mean, are you going to share them with the great podcast public?
You know, as you've asked me very nicely, Mike, I'm going to put them up tomorrow. So, yes, everybody will be able to have a glimpse at what they look like and how fabulous it was.
Yep. And in fact, they will be available today, won't they? So that's...
yes, indeed.
Absolutely marvellous. That's great. Oh, well that's great to hear. Because as I say, so many people have had to struggle through the lockdown. And I suppose that brings us inevitably to the fact that the pub's open this, you know, this Saturday. And I'm not sure if I'll go and seek a pub this Saturday, Leslie Ann, because I think it might be chaos. It's July the 4th, which is a very significant date in the American calendar. And everything that happens in America eventually comes over here. But I think it might be chaotic. I might restrain myself for another day. Now, you're not the sort of lady who goes sprinting down the road for a large gin and tonic the moment the pub's open, are you? However...
Well, no, I'm going to pour one indoors, actually,
exactly.
To celebrate.
Yeah, exactly. If I had to ask you, strange question, I suppose, to ask a lady of demure means, if you have a favourite pub, do you?
Well, it's a good question. On Fleet Street, my favourite pub was always the Old Bell.
Yes.
Because it's just out of the back door of St. Bride's Church, yeah. The journalist's church. And did you know, by the way, that, you know, it's Grade 2 listed. You would have walked past it 10,000 times.
Yes.
But it was built originally by Sir Christopher Wren to house his masons while they were building St. Bride's Church. Well, did you know that?
The Old Bell was built for the masons.
Yeah, it was an inn, and that's where they lived.
Wow, fantastic. Yeah. I always, when I do a bit of telly in towns, I get the car to take me afterwards to Fleet Street. Believe it or not, I love Fleet Street. And I meet a couple of mates there who are retired, right? And we go to the Old Bell. And, you know, there's a selection of great beers there, the wonky floorboards, and they serve sausages, literally three sausages in a, you know, a little dish. And we eat the sausages and drink the beer. And then we take a stroll up and down Fleet Street and, for some unknown reason, pose for pictures in front of the Daily Express building. We must have 100 of them, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but every time you go there. Yeah. I tell you who I took to the Old Bell once. He came and did a lecture in St. Bride's. We have a thing called the Olsen Lecture.
Yes.
Once a year. And Rick Wakeman very kindly came and gave the lecture for us. And I took him to the Old Bell afterwards. He doesn't drink anymore because he used to gun it, you know, you can imagine. So he drinks water.
He was married to Cher, wasn't he?
No, he was married to a Nina Carter.
Oh, right, okay.
A long time ago. One of the two, they were blonde. Were they blonde on blonde or something? They did.
Well, she was a very glamorous sort of glamour.
She was
model.
A page three girl, wasn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah. Yeah, I think she was, yeah.
He tells a very funny story about her breasts when she she gave an interview in one of the colour supplements one time. And she insisted to this interviewer that she'd never had any surgery to augment her significant bazoom.
Yeah.
At which point Rick turned around and said, "Can I have my money back then?"
That's very funny.
I took Rick and he was just enchanted by this old pub because it's like stepping back in time 500 years or so, isn't it? It's like something out of Harry Potter.
It's absolutely fabulous. Sometimes then my mate and I, who used to be a crime reporter on the Express, we go to the Cheshire Cheese. But I think the Cheshire Cheese is overrated. It's the pub, of course, that Samuel Pepys used to use. He used to live just up the alleyway there in Gough Square, I think. Was it Samuel Pepys or was it the other guy?
It was Pepys and Dr. Johnson's house.
Dr. Johnson,
there,
that's him.
It's
got
a lot of literary history, that little passageway.
Oh, it definitely has. You're absolutely right. But I find the Cheshire Cheese, which is a magnet for tourists, by the way, Americans, New Zealand, Australians, you know, in the summer all piling in there. It's just a warren of little rooms, which I don't think are very appealing. I don't know about you, but I always used to try and give it a wide berth.
Well, we had my youngest daughter's christening lunch in there, funnily enough.
Really?
There's a vast room down in the basement.
There is.
And we had that. And one of her godparents is Frank Warren, the boxing promoter.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he had his massive Rolls Royce outside on the pavement, blocking the traffic. It was quite soon after he'd been shot. Do you remember?
Yes, when he was, that's right. And he was shot by, everybody knows who shot him, but the man who shot him.
We can't say the name.
And was never brought to justice, yeah.
So Frank had a bodyguard at that time of his life, and he was being driven around by a chauffeur in his roller, which was on that bit of stretch of road, you know, there, and blocking the buses and goodness knows what, so he could come in for Bridie's christening party.
Mm. How lovely that is. My favourite pub in the world, I've only ever been there once, is called the Pirate's Pub, and it's in the middle of the Caribbean Sea, near to the British Virgin Islands. When I was staying on Necker, which is Richard Branson's island, we stayed there for like 3 days. One evening, somebody said, come on, we're going to get a Boston Whaler and go to the pub. And I thought, this is, you know, such a mysterious and wonderful place. And we get the Boston Whaler, which is a little flat-bottom boat, which you literally steer by standing up at the back, you know. And this speck of rock in the distance suddenly came into view. And we beached there. There's a little marina jetty. It is literally a pub on a piece of rock in the middle of the Caribbean Sea. It's got a jukebox full of English records from 60s, 70s and 80s. There are people sitting around smoking dope and it's all hey man and all this kind of stuff. It's staffed and run by British people, Scottish, Irish, whatever you want to call it. But it is the most unique pub I've ever seen in anywhere in the world. And the next time I was in that part of the world, I was in Antigua, which is close by. And I said, look, I don't care how long it takes. I'm going to hire a boat. We're going to the Pirates Pub. Some smart businessman had bought it and turned it into one of the world's most exclusive restaurants. And it doesn't surprise me. But what a terrible shame that it's not a pub anymore. I mean, people would literally, you know, step off the boat onto the jetty, which was only about 30 feet long. They'd walk up, go into the pub, stay there for 10 hours, come out and inevitably miss their footing trying to get back onto their boat, always end up in the sea. You know what I mean? It was just a magical, magical place, a sparkling jewel in the middle of the Caribbean Sea. And I'll never forget it because it was a one-off appearance. But anyway, there we go. Now,
I tell you where else I loved, by the way. Did you ever go to the Bells of Hell in New York?
The Bells of Hell go ring-a-ring-a-ring. Yes, it was up on, wasn't it up on about 80th Street?
Yeah, down in the Village, actually, this particular branch of the Bells of Hell.
Excuse me. Not only did I go to the Bells of Hell, of course it was down in the Village. The guy who ran it is a very good friend of mine, Peter. He's a butcher.
Peter Myers?
Peter Myers from Keswick.
He's my dad's best friend.
You're joking.
No, I'm really not joking.
Oh, Myers of Keswick.
That's amazing. He founded Myers of Keswick, the grocery store for expats in New York.
Yes.
And how that store came about, because his dad, his own father, had a butcher's store up in Keswick called Myers of Keswick.
Yes.
And so Peter and my dad knew each other from army days. And Peter made his way to New York. When he didn't have any money, he used to tap into the electricity supply of New York State and kind of basically steal the electricity.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Which he then sold on to run his life. Amazing story. And his father came over to stay with him at the pub.
Yeah.
And his dad, just to pass the time of day, used to make pork pies
yeah.
and little sort of sausage rolls and things
yeah.
and put them out happy hour yeah. on the bar for
that's
people
right.
just to have. And that idea led to the whole notion of having a shop where he could sell things for people who were sort of missing home and
absolutely.
The comforts of England.
Oh, absolutely. He made himself a millionaire out of it. What used to happen was we were in Costello's every Friday afternoon, the end of the week, and if you were in town, sometimes you weren't, sometimes you were away or out of town working or whatever, you know. But Peter would come up at 2:30 and he'd have a rucksack full of pork pies, which he'd cooked in his own oven down in the Village, okay? And he used to cycle up. Now, you know what Manhattan's like? It's a big slope up from the Village up to Midtown. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, he used to do it. And you used to put your order in, 4 pork pies, 6 pork pies, whatever, you know. He used to get out that pub at 5 o'clock, go home and eat our English pork pies. But you're absolutely right. He turned that into Myers of Keswick. He became a great friend of ours, you know, to all the English journalists. And I might have told you the story before about me being in his shop. Myers of Keswick started in a really run-down area downtown, down the Village. And, of course, now it's in the middle of, you know, multi-million-pound flats. It's all been renovated and he's got a very prosperous property. But
he's back here now. He lives in England again now.
Well, he lives between the two. But Peter...
No. He's retired. He gave Jenny the shop. Jenny's his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
And it's shut down at the moment because of everything that's going on. But he's back here. He's living back in Keswick. And I've been up to stay with him.
Oh,
how amazing that I've known you all this time and known him all this time.
Exactly.
And never knew this.
Well, the other thing is he came to one of our shows. Peter came to one of our London shows, the two Mike shows, live. It was the first time I've been here for years. But Peter was importing a container of baked beans and all sorts of things from England once a month, getting them cleared through customs and making a fortune. And I'm sure I've told you the story that I used to go and see him at 6 o'clock on a Friday when he shut, and we'd sit in his little shop, which had one table and 2 chairs, drinking cocktails, which he was making behind the bar.
And pouring them out of a teapot.
Pouring them out of a teapot, absolutely. And it was on that occasion we got the phone call from Keith Richard, who needed a huge spread for that night. He was having a surprise party. And Peter had to call all his staff back. He had to make pies and sausages. And we delivered them all to Keith Richard's house. And that was when Keith Richard was lying on the couch with a joint in one hand and a bottle of Jack Daniels in the other.
That's hilarious.
And that was all down to Peter.
Well, you know, Keith Richards, whenever he got back to the States, before he went home, upstate New York, his first port of call would always be Myers of Keswick, so he could have a cup of tea with Peter before he went home.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible. Oh,
that is amazing. How extraordinary.
Utterly amazing. Now then, Leslie-Anne, as you know, I'm trying to work on my languages. So I say to you, bonjour, s'il vous plaît, arrivederci, ciao. Now, what do you think about all that?
Est-ce que vous parlez en français ou quoi?
Yes, I'm working on that one. Do I speak French? Yes, I picked
up. Oh, very good. Yeah, I was going to say we had one of those, but it died. You're sounding pretty good, Mike.
Well, the reason I'm sounding good is I've found this great new service, which we have spoken about before. I want to get much better at what I'm doing, and to enable me to do that, I'm using Babbel, okay? Now, Babbel, I'm finding absolutely terrific because, you know, learning languages shouldn't be a complicated business. It should be easy. And as far as I'm concerned, Babbel, and that, by the way, is B-A-B-B-E-L. It's babbel.co.uk, or download the app to try for free, everybody who's listening now, and you will be able to access the same advantages as me. So, for instance, Leslie-Anne, you get a terrific service, in my view. It guides you through the learning process very, very smoothly. And I think you're going to tell me you don't have to spend all day doing it.
Well, it's designed to quickly get you speaking the new language within weeks, just with daily 10 to 15 minute lessons. It's quite amazing, isn't it?
That's absolutely fantastic. One thing I really like about it, having used it now and explored it, it teaches real life conversations, specializing in getting pronunciations and accents just right, because there's nothing worse, is there, than having a new language but not pronouncing it or sounding right.
Very true. And also the lessons are created by more than 100 language experts.
Yeah.
You know, real people and not just by a translation machine.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. You can choose from 14 different languages, all the major European languages and many more around the world.
And this teaching method has been proven to be effective across multiple studies.
Wow, that's great. Now, Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress will be synced across all devices. So what I'm saying is, folks, is try Babbel today. Just go to babbel.co.uk or download the app for absolutely free.
That's Babbel, BABBEL.co.uk, or download the app to try for free.
Absolutely right. So come on, folks, Babbel, learn a new language and make it your own. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for being with us. The first part of the show today was sponsored by Babbel, and we've just told you all about that. Now, Leslie-Anne, there's a subject I've got to address with you. I'm sure you know a lot about the inside of it. What on earth is going on with the Elton John situation regarding his one-time wife, lady called Renata, is it? Or Renata?
Renata Blowell.
Who apparently hadn't had any contact with him since their divorce of many, many years ago. But now, since his autobiography came out, Me, Elton John, and the biopic film that's been made of him, she's apparently made an approach to the High Court for reasons not many people seem to know.
Well, I had a chat with a couple of people over the weekend who are in the know, right, and it would seem that the paperback version of his memoir, Me, as you rightly say, is about to be published. Both Elton and Renata had signed an NDA. They had a non-disclosure agreement in place. He's broken it because he's written about her in the book. She clearly feels very aggrieved indeed and misrepresented, and she's hauling him over the coals because he broke the agreement.
Yeah. So is that all it is? But I mean, everything he said about her in the book, because I read the extracts, I haven't read the book, they were all very kind and very warm. And, you know, he said things like, if I'd have been a completely straight guy, she'd have been the perfect woman for me. What I don't understand is how on earth she ever accepted the proposal of marriage in the first place, 4 days after the proposal they got married, when it was very, very widely known amongst the population, and particularly for people like you on the inside of the business, that Elton John was very gay.
Yeah, but what is gay? I mean, you know, we are much more enlightened in this day and age about the spectrum of sexuality. Aren't we? So it's black one end, it's white the other end, and there's an awful lot of grey in between.
Yeah.
And lots of people, I think the vast majority of people, have the potential to be bisexual, to be attracted to someone of the opposite sex or the same sex. Yeah. What difference does it make? Elton had had girlfriends before. So it wasn't as if she was his first experience.
Yes.
And I think, you know, she was working. In fact, I know she was working as a tape op at Air Studios above Topshop on Oxford Circus, as it was in those days.
Right. I know that shop.
She was just a lowly, humble engineer.
Yeah.
A pretty, quiet, softly spoken German woman.
Yes.
And in comes Elton to record an album. And they obviously had a spark between them, and he was smitten. And I think he probably thought, oh, this is the answer to all my prayers. You know, I can just marry this sweet girl and live happily ever after. And I can prove to myself once and for all that I don't want to live that wild gay lifestyle that I've been living to date. I can be a normal person, normal as was understood in those days. Let's not offend anybody here.
But no.
Of course, it didn't work out. And she's just a very poorly paid tape op.
Yeah.
And he swept her off her feet. He's a globally famous, popular, beloved rock star. Imagine the lifestyle change for someone like her. He would have been very hard to turn down. He's a very sweet, charming, smooth-tongued man.
Yes.
And I'm sure she just lost her reason to him.
That's amazing. I read in one of the accounts over the weekend that one of his big friends is Nina Miskew. Fleet Street.
Yeah, Nina Mishkoff. Yeah.
Nina Mishkoff, that's right, yeah. And
another friend of mine, Patty Nolder, was their bridesmaid, by the way.
Bridesmaid, golly, that's
yeah, they got married down in Australia, yeah.
Yeah, I also read that she got between £5 and £10 million in a settlement, which is extraordinary for a marriage that never really happened, if you see what I mean, you know.
But he ridiculed her and he humiliated her. And, you know, the fact is, even if he wrote nice things in his memoir, he broke the agreement. He invaded her privacy. She's married to somebody else now. She has a whole different life. It could well be that she lives somewhere where nobody knows about her past.
Right.
And about that she was ever even connected to Elton John.
Yeah.
That she was ever even Mrs. Elton John in the first place.
Yeah.
Or Mrs. Reg Dwight or whatever. Yeah. So she might now be humiliated all over again. Mm. Because people have now read the book, seen the film, and they've put two and two together and realised it's her.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. He took her, just an odd quirk of time, to the FA Cup final in 1984 because Everton were playing. I was working and living in America and I had to go to Toronto to see the cup final because in those days football was so insignificant in America, they didn't even carry the English cup final. So I went with a girlfriend to Toronto and watched it there. And the images of Elton John on the pitch with his wife, Renata. But not only that, but the Everton players were, I mean, completely overwhelmed. You know, this guy, Elton John, who was chairman of Watford, he still is a fanatical football fan, you know, came along and shook hands with him. And they rated that much better than the Royal Visitor, obviously, you know, who was there on the day. Now, one of our mutual friends, Mr. Roger Taverner, did spend a lot of time, didn't he, getting, you know, behind this story by going and visiting Renata in the mansion that they shared in Old Windsor.
In Windsor, yeah. He and I worked on that story together,
exactly.
Actually. We were working for the competition. I was doing it for the Daily Mail. He was on the Express.
He was under my control on the Express.
Yeah, you were his boss. So, we kind of teamed up on that. That was a terribly illegal thing to do back then, wasn't it?
Oh, of course, you know,
you don't work with journalists from other papers. But
well, no,
if
I'd have known he'd been working with you, I'd have sacked him because, as you quite rightly say, you know, the competition was so fierce. But, I mean, I think you did it on a sort of day-by-day basis, didn't you? One day you had a great exclusive, next day you had it, you know. Sort of
there was quite a lot of trading going on in those days.
Yeah.
You know, it was underhand and we shouldn't have done it, but we all did it.
Wrong with that. I mean, we all know that when you're working in that sort of arena, sometimes it's better to be a man, and there was a woman involved here, Renata. Sometimes it's better to be a woman because women confide with women when they don't confide with men. So I think you were probably, the two of you, a pretty formidable and dynamic team.
Yeah, we worked well together, as you well know. but I liked Renata a lot.
Yep.
I felt sorry for her. I also felt sorry for him because he tried his best. And, you know, he could have ended up with a nice family and some children with her and so on. It ruined both their lives, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And it's something that you will never move away from.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Now, Leslie Ann, I want to talk to you about a subject which, sent a bit of a shiver up my back. You and I both read extensively. I don't know why, but sometimes I read these agony aunt columns, you know what I mean? Just really to get a perspective on life and, you know, am I the only one in life who's got problems? What do other people suffer from? I read this devastating one in the last couple of days in a glossy sort of colour mag, and it was a woman who bitterly regrets the fact that she helped her friend to cheat on her husband, that is the friend's husband. So what you've got here is you've got a woman ringing up a friend and saying, look, I've got the opportunity to see another bloke, but I don't want my husband to know. Would you cover for me? OK. And she did. And now she feels terribly guilty. Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, yeah. And I feel so horribly guilty about it to this day. I lent my house to a friend who was, she'd been away on a conference.
Yes.
She's a teacher, actually. She'd been away on a conference. She'd met another teacher and they wanted to, you know, explore their attraction to each other,
yes,
let's say. And so I lent her the keys to my house and I went somewhere.
Yeah.
And I mean, her husband is a friend of mine. I know them both equally well and I see them all the time. And every time I see them, I still feel racked with guilt.
Yeah.
That I basically betrayed him as well, her husband.
Yes.
They're still together. They've got a lovely family and, you know, they're very happy.
So did he know about the relationship?
No, and they got past it and she repaired the marriage. But
no, that's what
I'm
I mean.
The one left. So that, you know, I'm infected with the guilt. So every time I see them, it's me who's coming out in a cold sweat thinking, oh my God, you know, if they find out what happened here, or he does, then they're going to dump me as a friend. And really, I was an accessory to the crime.
You were, but does the husband know about the affair his wife had?
No.
So this day?
No, he doesn't. No. No, if you want to, you know, preserve your marriage, why would you tell him?
No, but some people can't live with it in their conscience. Now, I've got an almost similar story. I worked with somebody in Fleet Street who came to me and said that they were, again, going to have an assignation. And it was a weekend I was away, and I lent this friend my house, fully enough. I mean, I had a housekeeper at the time, got her to, you know, put towels out and all that kind of stuff in the spare bedroom, all that kind of stuff, you know. But I did it really as a sort of sense of helping him out to the extent where he told his wife he was going to be on a golfing weekend with me, okay? I was away anyway, but I let him use my house. But on my answer phone, I put a message saying that I was away playing golf with a colleague from work. I wouldn't be available till tomorrow. That's how deeply I got myself into it, you know? But I felt so dreadful about it ever since because the person this guy was having an affair with was his wife's best friend.
Oh, God, Mike. I mean, that is even worse, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you still see these people?
No. Relations, you know, just disappeared, just evaporated when Fleet Street broke up. We all went different ways and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But I feel terrible about it this day. The even crueler sort of outcome of this is that the guy was honourable and he did marry the woman he spent the weekend with because she'd become his mistress, right? He left his wife. When he went to see the husband of the mistress and explained the situation, the guy said fair enough and moved out and revealed later he'd been wondering how to get out of his marriage for a number of years and was delighted when this guy walked up the garden path and said he was going to take his wife from him. Couldn't believe his luck. He also paid the children's school fees. How about that? You know.
Well, that is a kind of a happy ending because everybody got out of it what they needed to get out of it. So,
except for one thing.
Well, what?
The first wife, who was heartbroken when found out that her best friend had been cohabiting with her husband. And secondly, very, very sadly, 10 years later, the lady died of cancer. First wife, the second wife.
Oh, no.
Yes.
That's like a punishment, isn't it?
Almost. And the first wife is still alive. So is the chap I'm talking about. But the lady in the middle died of cancer. Terribly tragic. And these things haunt you and really torment you for a long, long time.
Oh, it happened to my sister, you know.
Really?
My middle sister. So she and her husband were very friendly with another couple at the school gates.
Yes.
You know, they got to know each other, dropping kids off and picking them up and all that.
Yep.
And they started to have dinner parties together and everything. And then the woman stole my sister's husband. And it put my sister in hospital for a long, long time.
Oh, I'm not surprising.
And she's remarried again now, but she, you know, for a long, long time, she was very unwell.
Yeah. God, that really is terrible.
So betrayal, I mean, betrayal is a terrible thing.
Yes.
And best not go there, I think.
No, I totally agree. Okay, folks, well, welcome back to Life on Planet Porky. Great to have you with us again today. And can I just tell you, the rest of the show today is in association with ExpressVPN. Okay, now, Leslie Ann, we all know how ExpressVPN protects your privacy and security online. We know that, okay. But here's something you out there might not know. You might not know that you can also use VPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Now that we're all stuck at home, and I have to say that's been a bit of a pain, Leslie Ann, hasn't it? But we've had to, you know, it's been a pressure and we've had to get over it. But, you know, here's something that might relieve you. It's only a matter of time until we all run out of programs to watch on Netflix, for instance, okay? So this week, I've been using ExpressVPN to binge on Star Trek Discovery on Netflix UK. Absolutely smashing facility to come across, believe me.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. It's so simple to do as well. I just fire up the ExpressVPN app, change my location in the UK, refresh Netflix, and that's it. Now, because you see ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want the sites to think you are located, you can choose from 100 different countries. So just think about all of that. Think about the Netflix libraries that you can go through.
So, love anime? Use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service, Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason I use ExpressVPN to watch shows is that it's ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag, and you can stream in HD, no problem.
Oh, absolutely fabulous. Now, ExpressVPN, folks, and thank you for that, Leslie Ann, is also compatible with all your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and much, much more. So you can watch what you want on a personal device or on the big screen, wherever you are. Now, if you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/porky, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself with ExpressVPN at expressvpn.com/porky. Okay, folks, and as I say, joining us for the rest of the show in association with ExpressVPN. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you for being with us. I have to say, Leslie Ann, we've been through a gamut of emotions so far this podcast, haven't we? You know,
I've got to lie down here. I've got sweat pouring off my brow.
I know. Who's that guy who sang "Wherever I Leave My Hat, That's My Home"? Is that Paul Young?
Oh, Paul Young. Yeah,
yeah, Paul Young. Yeah, read a piece.
Lovely guy.
Oh, is it? I was going to ask you. Have you done? You've done work with him. You've done stuff with him.
I still know Paul to this day. We email each other, you know, from time to time.
Well, that's
he lost his wife recently, very sadly.
Oh,
Stacey.
Oh,
yeah,
dear.
She died. Very, very sad.
Anyway, I read a bit about him because he did a holiday feature. You know, he probably got a free holiday out of it. We used to take free holidays, didn't we? Well, I certainly did anyway.
Whenever we could, yes.
Whenever we could, yeah, and then write a feature about it. So they ask him the old Q&A, you know, the best holiday you've been on, worst holiday, all that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, what's your worst holiday irritation? So he said, I always try to keep a low profile. Whenever we went on holiday as kids and all that, you always knew when there was a doctor in the house, because he was the guy who shied away from everybody. If anybody was known as a doctor in a tourist hotel on the Costa Blanca, he was plagued by people for the whole week. You know what I mean? I've got a dodgy stomach. Oh, I've got sunburn, all that kind of stuff, you know. So Paul Young says in this piece that he always tried to keep a low profile and wear a hat and all that, because people would ask him to sing. You know, wherever I lay my hat is my home. And he said that, you know, sometimes when he said no, people would get really annoyed and say, well, why not? It doesn't take you 5 minutes. But I've come across this before, and it's so interesting. We were in the south of France doing something, I don't know what it was, and within company was somebody from the three tenors. Now, I don't mean the mega famous tenors like Placido Domingo, but there was another group, wasn't there, in this country called the three...
Oh, the Fivers, the Three Fivers, I think.
What were they? The Three Fivers.
The Three Fivers, yeah.
It could well be. But anyway, they'd been on television, you know, and they had a bit of reputation, all that kind of stuff. So there was one of them there. So somebody around the table said, oh, you know, give us a song. So this bloke said, what do you do in life? And the chap who made the request said, I'm an insurance broker. He said, oh, that's great. He said, look, do us a favour, will you? Can I have a free insurance policy for my motor car and my house? Yeah. And the guy said, what do you mean? He said, well, you don't give away your business for free, do you? And he said, no, of course I don't. I'd be bankrupt. He said, yeah, well, I'd be bankrupt if I stood up and sung every time somebody asked me to sing in public and doesn't want to pay me for it. Do you want to pay me for it? It was so interesting. And I thought, well, I can kind of understand what he's saying, but it wouldn't have cost him anything to sing, would it?
Well, there's a couple of points here. First of all, you know, singers can't just do it off the cuff, especially not as they age. They have to prepare their voice.
Right.
They can't just do it. You know, they have to do vocal exercises, warm-ups, larynx massages. I bet you've never had one of those, have you?
A larynx massage. I've had women with hands around my throat, but whether it's a larynx...
For other reasons, But no, they can't just do it off the cuff. They have to get ready and, you know, they have to build up to it and be sort of match fit, if you like.
Yeah.
There's only one singer I've ever come across who, when people were yelling out at this sort of lunch awards ceremony thing I went to at the Savoy a few years ago, and people were going, give us a song, give us a song. It was Bonnie Tyler, and fair game, she got up, got on stage and belted out a couple of songs like a good Welsh woman, you know. But there are very few singers who can do it without considerable preparation. So I have every sympathy for Paul Young.
Yeah, Rod Stewart never does it. You know, I've been fortunate enough to be in company with Rod, going to football matches and that kind of stuff. And one of the reasons is because people of his eminence, and this happened with Michael Jackson in New York at the New York Metropolitan Museum, when he got some award there, somebody said, give us a song. Apparently, if the acoustics aren't right in the building you're in, it completely distorts the sound that you have spent years perfecting, you know what I mean?
Not only that, but they have to have their musicians with them. Yeah. They've got to control their pitch and their key and the tone of their voice and all those things. You know, there's a lot goes into a performance.
Oh, that's right.
And I think we can see this. I don't know whether you watched any of the Glastonbury over the weekend, but mostly live music does not broadcast very well. And it's partly to do with being out in the open air. People always say, oh, look when Paul McCartney performed outside Buckingham Palace for the Queen's Jubilee or whatever it was. Doesn't he sound awful? Well, frankly, nobody sounds great live in the open air.
Right.
And there aren't really ways of fixing that. So even with all today's technology, with all the, you know, the digital kind of desks and the speakers that they have and everything else at their fingertips, it's still not something you can really rely on. So the bigger the star, as you've just mentioned, Rod Stewart, you know, the more they have to lose and the more they have to come across as they sound on the record.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. You know, being a man who doesn't really like live concerts because I like the absolute reproduction of the studio sound, I can perfectly understand that. Have you ever come across a lady called Emily Sheffield, who is Samantha Cameron's little sister?
Yes, she used to write for Vogue. She's I wouldn't say a journalist, but a sort of feature writer.
Well, she is a journalist now, because the reason I'm asking you is she's been appointed the editor of the biggest evening newspaper in the country, the London Evening Standard.
Yes, I know. Because George Osborne was the editor, wasn't he? And he's now gone upstairs. Is he editor in chief or something?
That was a joke anyway. He knew nothing about journalism, and he was just there because Evgeny? What's his name?
Evgeny.
Evgeny, thank you. Well done. Who owned the paper, who was the son of a Russian billionaire, just needed him for, you know, just power reasons, really, because George Osborne, former chancellor, knew everybody around the world.
Well, he's also worked on the Telegraph, so, you know, he wasn't entirely a stranger to the wiles of Fleet Street.
But, yeah.
I mean, this does smack of nepotism, doesn't it?
Oh, completely. And we've discussed nepotism in the past, and I've said it's not necessarily a bad thing if you're qualified to do it. But, you know, look, I'm not trying to be critical or judgmental. I've never met Emily Sheffield.
You are.
Well, yes, I suppose
you
I am.
You definitely are being, yes.
All right, well, I've never met Emily Sheffield, but I have met former editors of the Evening Standard in the days when I worked in Fleet Street, like you did, and they were the best of the best because they were running papers that had to react instantly. They didn't have hours to wait until publication time. They had to change front pages, back pages, everything. And I think it's a bit of a shame, really, that it's gone out to sort of, you know, to somebody as a PR job.
I agree. I mean, there's plenty of real journalists out there who do the job much better. It takes very special skills to be an editor, doesn't it?
Oh, very, very special.
But there's something a bit dodgy about this as well, because this woman has also received various grants for business startups that don't seem to have gone anywhere. So she obviously knows all the right people, if you know what I mean.
I know. I quite liked Sam Cam, by the way, David Cameron's wife. I thought she handled herself quite well as, you know, the sort of first lady equivalent in this country. I don't know if you ever met her, did you?
Yep, once or twice. She was a bit of a raver in her day. Well, she went to Bristol University and she hung around with musicians down there.
Yeah.
And she was quite a gal.
Really?
Before she bumped into David and, you know, became a fine, upstanding pillar of the establishment.
I totally agree. And talking about first ladies, I read a very extensive sort of biog or profile of Melania Trump, revealing, this is in one of the Sunday Column magazines, that everybody thinks she's just a dumb blonde and just stands there and does nothing. But according to the insider piece I wrote from Washington, read from Washington, she has an awful lot of influence on Donald and is responsible for quite a lot of his, you know, measures that have caused so much controversy.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? I've never taken her seriously since she ripped off Michelle Obama's speech for her own maiden address.
Yes.
And it was discovered and she was ridiculed everywhere. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Look, I mean, how much clout does she really have? I should imagine he's a tremendous bully and that he practically tells her what to wear every time appear on camera.
You can't. Yeah. How can you make a judgment that a man's a bully when we know nothing whatsoever about the intimacy of their private life?
Yeah, you're right. I'm making an assumption, and assumptions are the root of all cock-ups.
Well, they certainly can be. I think she's very glamorous. I mean, you know, she's stunningly good-looking, wears very high
heels. All right. She's not very animated, is she? I mean, there's not much character to her, as far as I can see. She's a bit two-dimensional.
Well, maybe. I thought it was great, because everybody assumed, with Donald Trump and his background and that terrible video that was released when he was talking so dismissively and revoltingly about women and how he approaches them. We all know what we're talking about here, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody assumed that she was sort of some sort of Ukrainian good time girl, for want of a better word. And in fact, she sued successfully a publication that suggested she'd once been an escort.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you?
I suppose you would if you had that kind of money, but I wonder if they've got a pole in their bedroom.
A pole? Oh, you're being dismissive again. A pole dancer now. You're reducing it to pole dancing duty.
Maybe he uses it. Who knows? I just fantasize.
I think that's very harsh. Talking about Mr. Trump, by the way, he's fallen out with Mick Jagger, hasn't he?
Oh, in a big way, yes. He's been using Stones music for his campaign and his rallies.
Yeah.
And the Stones have hit back and said, you know, cease and desist. You may not use this music again. And he's basically putting up two fingers to them and going, sue me.
Yeah.
They ought to have a license to be able to use the track in question. Ooh. I'm not even going to say the name of it in case I get in trouble.
Yeah.
In this country, it would be a PPL license. You have to be licensed to broadcast something in a public space. So even in a garage, a hairdressing salon, a shop, anywhere that plays live music, recorded music, has to have the appropriate license.
Yes.
I don't know what it would be called in the States. But of course, Trump has enough money that he can just carry on doing what he wants. He'll just say, sue me, and they will. Mm. And the only winners in a situation like this, as always, are the lawyers.
Well, absolutely right. And it only proves, doesn't it, that you can always get what you want.
You're taking a chance there, Mike.
No, not at all. And I went to the inauguration balls for Bill Clinton. I was living and working in Washington at the time. That was the first time I got sacked as news editor of the Express.
That's a great line. You've been to Bill Clinton's balls.
Yes. Well, I lived on the same street as him. I lived at 617 Pennsylvania. I think I've told
you.
He
let that one go.
He lived in 1600. And I've also told the story. I got to know his mum because nobody else gave Bill Clinton a hope in hell. But I kind of knew he was going to win because I could see it all collapsing for Bush. But anyway, that's another story. She invited me to her. By the way, there's about 30 inaugural balls on the night of the inauguration. And I went to just one where he only stays 5 minutes and then goes again. But the one I went to was attended by Fleetwood Mac, who he'd asked to attend because he'd used their fantastic record, Don't Think About Tomorrow, wasn't it, for his campaign.
Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. I bet nobody said to them, get up and give us a song.
That's right. Yeah, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Yeah, brilliant song. So so I know all about the way that, you know, those American politicians try and jump on the old bandwagon. Now, let me ask you this. Have you ever come across Ms. Chrissy Hynde?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
She was married to a music journalist called Nick Kent.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
She's a feisty bird. I've always liked her very much.
Yes, and me. She made some great records, you know, Chain Gang and all that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Back on the Chain Gang and all that.
There's something very sexy as well about a woman playing lead guitar, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, I think so, yeah. Now, the reason I like her is because she said that, I'll read this piece here. In this age of political correctness, rock star Chrissy Hynde dares to strike a discordant note. It says, the Pretender singer has suggested women will be taken seriously only if they wear modest outfits. How you dress and how you present yourself to the world is totally how people will treat you, says Hynde, who is now 68. That's amazing, isn't it?
She? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. All these so-called feminists who complain because people treat them like they're hookers, well, just put some clothes on. If you walk around looking like a sex worker, you'll probably be treated like a sex worker. And if you walk around in a nurse's uniform, people will call you when you're sick. And if you walk around dressed like a roadie, like I do, people will just say, leave the fuck alone.
Excuse the language. This is a family show. Yeah. This is a very controversial territory we're straying into here.
Yeah.
So we're into the arena of slut shaming,
yeah,
victim blaming, and women's empowerment.
Yes.
Do you remember that film, The Accused, with Jodie Foster?
Yes, I do.
Back in 1988.
Yes,
she played a young waitress. She was gang raped by three guys in a local bar.
Yeah.
And over a table, and the men in question and the guys all standing around who encouraged them to rape her, they were all prosecuted and she won. The woman won.
Yes.
Now, the suggestion was, the defense proposed that women ask for it by the way they dress.
Yeah.
This is not how we think today and how we choose to look. However we choose to look, if we want to look like a slut walking down the road, we are not asking for it. We're not inviting you to attack us. Having said that, I always, my youngest daughter will tell you this, to her great chagrin, every time she's going out looking very nice but pretty sexy, I always say, cover yourself up. Have you got a top to put on when you get back in the cab to come home later? Because unfortunately, even though she's not saying I'm asking for it, there are people who will misinterpret her image.
Yes. No, I totally agree. And I think it's, I mean, I'm not a father. I haven't had children like yourself. But I know from, you know, my experience of growing up with people who have got children, it's any father's worst fear when a daughter gets to about the age of 15 and is wearing micro minis and that kind of stuff. It must be a nightmare. It must be a nightmare for a mother like you.
Yeah, and I think we only realise that as we sort of get into our middle age. And and I think back to some of the outfits I went out in, and I used to hide it from my parents. You know, I'd go out dressed in jeans and a nice sort of demure jacket, and I'd get into somebody's car, and then off it would come. The miniskirt would go on, the little bra top, the whole bit. And I cringe now at some of the outfits I went out in. And so I'm probably doubly worried about my daughter because I know what's out there.
Yes, well, exactly. That's always the problem, isn't it? Right. OK, well, Leslie Ann, that brings us to the end of another Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
It's always a pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
It's very good of you. Thank you also to our sponsors in this podcast, Babbel and ExpressVPN. And Leslie Ann, you and I will be back with our audience again very soon.
Doesn't drink anymore because he used to gun it, you know, you can imagine. So he drinks
married
water.
To Cher, wasn't he?
No, he was married to Nina Carter.
Oh, right, okay.
A long time ago. One of the two, they were blonde. Were they blonde on blonde or something? They did.
Well, she was a very glamorous sort of glamour.
She was
model.
A page three girl, wasn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah. Yeah, I think she was, yeah.
He tells a very funny story about her breasts when she she gave an interview in one of the colour supplements one time, and she insisted to this interviewer that she'd never had any surgery to augment her significant bazoom.
Yeah.
At which point Rick turned around and said, "Can I have my money back then?"
That's very funny. Yeah.
Singers can't just do it off the cuff, especially not as they age. They have to prepare their voice.
Right.
They can't just do it. You know, they have to do vocal exercises, warm-ups, larynx massages. I bet you've never had one of those, have you?
A larynx massage? I've had women with hands around my throat, but whether it's a larynx...
For other reasons, yeah.
Look, I can't. I'm not trying to be critical or judgmental. I've never met Emily.
Yeah, you are.
Well, yes, I suppose
you
I am.
You definitely are being.